Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back great guest co-host, Dr. Jamil Battle. Welcome, Jamil.
You're welcome.
On our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. John Abramowitz, professor of clinical psychology and director of the Anxiety and Stress Lab at the University of North Carolina and editor of the Journal of Obsessive Compulsive and Related Disorders, about what it really means to have OCD or obsessive compulsive disease. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
I'm looking forward to it as well.
But first, we're going to look at some research that matters. And our first is online gaming addictions. That is really some sort of compulsion for some people, right?
It really is. And it's actually pretty prevalent. Apparently, there's more than 55 million online console gamers in the U.S.
And people start playing these games and they find it very hard to stop. And this was actually research that was looking to see in men, where much of the gaming occurs more than women, does it affect their brain's impulse control? And they were looking at functional MRI, magnetic resonant imaging of the brain, to look at the differences in the brains of men and women who are addicted to online gaming.
And it looks like they studied 32 men and 23 women with internet gaming disorder and matched those to 30 men and 22 females that were healthy, and found it looks like an activity level that was more profound in the impulse control area of the brain. And also their scores on the Barrett impulsiveness scale was also used, and it looks like there was a correlation with lower activity in the prefrontal lobe that's very important for controlling impulsivity.
Right, and this was much more so in men than in women. It kind of adds to our understanding of why it is that this gaming addiction, among other things, can really be bad, because it leads to this impulse control problems. This can be associated with negative work performance, negative school performance, problems in relationships, all of which are associated with this time playing. And then this can also lead to withdrawal when you're not playing. So that's a problem like many other addictions.
Exactly. It's very much similar to what happens with substance abuse.
And I think we're going to see more of this as time goes on. So it's important that listeners and other providers are more aware of this and can counsel. It's not just a game.
Exactly.
Let's talk about something else that certainly isn't a game. And this is about violence in neighborhoods. And why were the researchers interested in this topic, Jamil?
Well, neighborhood violence has been associated with adverse health effects on youth, including sleep loss, asthma, and metabolic syndrome.
And so trying to figure out why, though, some youth and children who are exposed to neighborhood violence don't seem to have the same kind of worse outcomes as those that are exposed. And the things one might expect, if you witness and around violence, you may have worse health outcomes, including violence yourself, but also things like high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, worse cardiometabolic problems.
And it looks like they tested 218 eighth graders from Chicago and looking at obesity and metabolic health, and their neighborhood factors, including the murder rates, and conducted functional MRIs. And it looks like there was an area of the brain called the CEN, which stands for the Central Executive Network, and that there was a lower CEN resting state in those that had a less resilience and adaptation.
Yeah. and this is not CNN, it's CEN. It's an area of the brain. This is a very sophisticated study. And basically, they were suggesting that there could be these kind of network areas of the brain that you might be able to help train and adapt to have those who are exposed to this neighborhood violence perhaps have enhanced abilities for self-control and modulating thoughts, which I think is really important. I also think it's just maybe even more important that we work on reducing neighborhood violence.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, you know, it's important that we can how we can respond to it. I do get that. But boy, it just makes me say, let's just work and recommit and to getting neighborhoods safer.
I like that thought. That's a great plan.
Yeah. I mean, because otherwise I feel like we're saying, well, it's up to you. If you see the violence, we're going to help you figure out how. I know that's important, but something at me just doesn't sit right.
Right.
Well, something that does sit right is our next research that matters. And these are some research that's reported on reducing sensitization to kids who are allergic to peanuts.
Well, that is a profound problem because peanut allergy can be life-threatening. And so if we can kind of dial down the intensity of the allergic reaction with, it sounds like, the peanut protein itself, that would definitely allow maybe these kids to live without having to be bound by peanut allergy.
Right. And this research was all over the place, literally, after it was reported at the annual meeting of the American College of Allergy. And these children who were exposed for 24 weeks to the equivalent of one peanut a day by a powder sprinkled on food. These were volunteers, kids with peanut allergies, and they found that 66% were able to tolerate the equivalent of being exposed to two peanuts a day, and 4% who got a dummy, the placebo, they didn't get any really peanut thing, were able to have that response. So these two-thirds of the kids could really tolerate exposure to more peanuts, so they had really not the reactions. Sounds really good. What's the catch here, Jamil?
Well, I think it sounds like there was a need for an epinephrine injection to reverse allergic reactions in a small percentage.
14%.
That's right.
Yeah, that's not
too small.
Not too
actually.
Small. And abdominal pain and vomiting were in 12% that had to get out of the study. So it was good for 66%,
yeah.
But there's a fair number of folks here who had some real problems.
Yes, that is true.
Had some real problems, and that was concerning to me.
Yeah.
I was also a little concerned that the makers of the powder were the sponsors of the study.
That's concerning.
A little bit, but I do think it's probably it is a standardized formulation, so therefore you could do this. But I do think this is a potential tool for some parents to discuss with the allergist.
I agree with that, and maybe if there is a chance that maybe someone with peanut allergy can have a transformation and maybe experience traveling or sleeping over a friend's house, things like that, where, you know, maybe there's accidental exposure, and maybe if they have this improved tolerance, maybe they could be comfortable in situations that they weren't before.
Wise words. Our last research that matters is actually research from those states who, under Obamacare, extended Medicaid. And there were up to 33 states that have done that. And then looking at the relationship between those that extended Medicaid and was there any reduction in kidney failure relating from undergoing dialysis treatment, presumably because more people who needed dialysis treatment now had access to Medicaid.
Wow, and this is exactly what we wanted the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, to do. And so it looks like this is one of the first studies to find an association between Medicaid expansion and lower death rates. And in states that expanded Medicaid, the percentage of kidney failure patients who die their first year on dialysis decreased from 7% to about 6%. And in non-expanded states, the death rate fell from 7 to 6.8%.
Even though it's a small absolute percentage, the relative increase is larger. And that would suggest that there are hundreds of patients a year who may be alive today as a result of this expansion. That's important. And if you are a loved one who got Medicaid expansion and was on dialysis, you have someone to thank.
That's right.
We won't say his name, but we all know who it is there. Good news there to end our research that matters. We're going to take a short break. But when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. John Abramowitz, professor of clinical psychology and director of the Anxiety and Stress Lab at the University of North Carolina, about what it really means to have obsessive compulsive disorder. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamil Battle. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jamil Battle. Today on Conversations, Jamil, we're talking with Dr. John Abramowitz, professor of clinical psychology and director of the Anxiety and Stress Laboratory at the University of North Carolina and editor of the Journal of Obsessive Compulsive and Related Disorders, about it, what it really means to have OCD, or Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. Welcome, Dr. Abramowitz.
Thanks very much for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, you were a guest a long time ago on the show where we talked about your work in anxiety,
right.
And it was so illuminating for me and really helpful, and I'm so excited to have you back here. So thank you for, first of all, coming back, but talking about something that's so important about OCD.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
You know, first off, before we kind of dive into this topic, help us understand a little bit more, for those who maybe don't remember that first interview years ago on anxiety, how did you get interested in this whole field? Because it's so important.
You know, everybody knows what it's like to have anxiety. It's a normal experience for all of us. It's kind of our body's fight or flight response. And I guess, you know, at some point I just found that very interesting, and the things that anxiety can drive us to do, the behaviors that it drives us to do that sometimes can be very adaptive, and in a you know, if it's taken to a certain extreme, it can be maladaptive. And sometimes the things that people do when they get really anxious kind of make their anxiety worse. And when I was in graduate school, I learned about that, found that fascinating. Most importantly, we have a very effective treatment for clinical anxiety. And so once I learned about that, and once I started, you know, learning how to help folks who have clinical anxiety successfully overcome that, I was hooked. This became my thing. I wanted to help people. I wanted to do research on it, contribute to knowledge, all of that.
So you say it makes people do things that makes things worse. Give me an example or two. I mean, I'm thinking like, oh, I could drink some alcohol because that'll calm me down.
Right. So that's one of the things. People sometimes will self-medicate with alcohol or drugs when they're feeling really anxious. An example would be someone who's afraid to go to parties. They're afraid of social interaction. And so they think, okay, if I have a few drinks, you know, that will make me, you know, calm down, and I'll feel, you know, a little more at ease and can have conversations with people. So in the short run, if they do that, that does help, and maybe they feel a little bit better. Of course, we won't get into the side effects, of course, of taking the drugs or the alcohol. But in the long run, that just makes their anxiety worse, because they learn that they need to rely on medicines or other sorts of avoidance behavior in order to be able to get through a situation like a party. And if they're worried about social, judgment from other people, social evaluation, then they think that the only way that they can perform successfully is if they've, you know, taken drugs or alcohol. And what we want to do is we want to help people to learn, no, people probably won't evaluate you as negative as you think. And even if they do evaluate you negatively, that's not the end of the world.
Boy, this sounds very, it sounds like it's maybe prevalent, or a lot of people are maybe suffering with this. Can you tell us a little bit more on how prevalent it is?
Yeah, we know that about somewhere between 20 and 25% of adults have, at some point in their life, have met the criteria for an anxiety-related clinical disorder.
And when we talk about obsessive compulsive disorder,
it's not just a subset of anxiety, though it could coexist with anxiety. It could coexist with lots of things. Tell us about that, because I think, boy, if we think there are people who have misperceptions about anxiety and depression, I bet it's misperception times two for something like obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the less understood problems that we know of, kind of in the mental health area. OCD involves two main types of symptoms. So obsessions are these unwanted, intrusive thoughts or ideas. We're talking about things like the idea that a person is contaminated with germs and they'll get sick, or the idea that they could, you know, kind of lose control and do something violent to someone that they really care about, they love, or an unwanted sexual idea or an unwanted immoral or a blasphemous thought, or the idea, thoughts about violence or harm. What if I hit someone with my car and I didn't realize it? So these ideas that kind of come up, and they're unwanted thoughts. The person doesn't like that they're there, and they try to resist those kinds of thoughts. And the thoughts make them, you know, uncomfortable and anxious or guilty. The way that people resist those kinds of thoughts is through compulsions, and that's the second of the two main symptoms of OCD, compulsions or compulsive rituals. And these are things that people with OCD do to try to reduce their discomfort with the obsession or to try to get rid of the thought altogether. So if you have someone who has, let's say, obsessions about contamination, the fear that, you know, I touched the doorknob and now I've got germs and I'm going to get really sick, they're going to go wash their hands, and that's going to make them feel better temporarily. Or someone who, we work with a lot of folks in our clinic who have, they've got a fear, like I mentioned before, that what if I hit someone with my car? Was that a speed bump or was that a person? And they spend a lot of time going back to check, more than just once. They might go back several times. They might get stuck going back over and over to make sure that it was a speed bump. People who have unacceptable religious, blasphemous thoughts or sexual thoughts, they might do rituals in their mind, mental rituals, to try to kind of counteract or get rid of those kinds of thoughts. Maybe a prayer or a sentence that they repeat to themselves. And then people with OCD often find themselves avoiding the triggers of these kinds of thoughts. And in the short term, the avoidance, the rituals, it kind of makes the obsession, it keeps it at bay sometimes. But in the long run, these kinds of behaviors just kind of reinforce the obsession. They make it worse. They make the person more anxious. And they get into this vicious cycle that just can get out of control and cause havoc with the person's life.
Yeah, I remember I had a patient years ago who, when I went to examine them, I discovered they had Saran wrap under their clothes. You could hear a crackling noise. Huh. And because they really didn't like germs. And this was a way of avoiding getting germs. And I just couldn't quite understand till I understood that not only did, you know, they were scared in the doctor's office. That amplified it. So coming to the doctor's office, you would think normally, okay, that's a place you can come to get better. They were really concerned about those germs.
Yeah, people will go to great lengths with OCD in order to try to control their anxiety and their fear and prevent their obsessions from coming true, going back and checking things. I've recently been working with someone who is afraid that she has revealed some sort of confidential information. She works in the mental health field. Mm-hmm. And so she's checking the pockets of her clothes. She's checking her car, going back to check her house, having trouble sending emails, having trouble writing anything down, because what if I reveal something, you know, confidential and I get into trouble, or this person feels betrayed and they get depressed or commit suicide, and these obsessional thoughts just kind of, you know, they get out of control.
Does it present, I would imagine, maybe differently depending on the population or group of people?
So certainly the environment has an effect. We know that, I guess the most interesting case of that has to do with religious OCD. So we know that religion kind of pops up for a lot of people as far as OCD goes. But you see Jewish people having obsessions about, did I break the laws of keeping kosher? You wouldn't see Jews having thoughts of, you know, what if I had a bad thought about Jesus, because Jews don't believe in Jesus. You see Christians who often have thoughts about, you know, am I saved? You don't see that in Judaism, because Jews don't worry about being saved. That's not a part of the Jewish tradition. You see it in Muslims presenting in different ways. You see it in Buddhists presenting in different ways. It's fascinating to see how the environment, how our surroundings influence the types of obsessions and compulsions that we have.
A lot of people probably have obsessions. You know, I'm obsessed about, you know, getting a grant score. You know, that's fundable.
I've been there.
Yeah, you know, and but the reality is with a 5-8%, you know, chance of getting it, you should be obsessed about it. But the compulsion I may not do. And I wonder if you can have obsessions without compulsions, and can you have compulsions without obsessions? And it's only if those two things get combined, it's a real problem.
Yeah. So clinically, we don't see one without the other very much. Usually, if the person has compulsions, they're doing some sort of repetitive behavior, but they don't. It's not in response to an obsessional fear. It's usually some other problem. Maybe they're perfectionistic. Maybe they have another problem like an impulse control problem, hair pulling, skin picking. And when people have obsessions without compulsions, sometimes they might have generalized anxiety. They might have depression, but also something else. Typically in OCD, we would see both obsessions and compulsions.
Maybe for me, it's just the reality. I'm not going to get funded.
I've been there.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. John Abramowitz, professor of clinical psychology and director of the Anxiety and Stress Lab at the University of North Carolina, about what it really means to have OCD. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. John Abramowitz, professor of clinical psychology and director of the Anxiety and Stress Lab at UNC and editor of the Journal of Obsessive Compulsive and Related Disorders, about what it really means to have OCD.
Right before we were at the break, you were really talking about how it may differ in the cases you said by faith, and I wonder, or religious ones. I wonder, are there certain occupations? And of course, Jamila and I both being doctors, so we're like looking at each other
right.
Like, okay, you got it, I got it. We suspect that doctors are at higher risk, but I don't know that for a fact. Are there some occupations where it might be, and why would that be the case?
You know, I'm not aware of research on different occupations, but certainly, you know, we see it presenting in doctors, for example. I'm thinking of a resident that I worked with years ago who was terrified of getting contaminated by blood. What mm-hmm. if they got a blood-borne illness and would wear, you know, extra layers of gloves and protection and masks and things like that when they were doing anything that would involve, you know, even drawing blood. And it got in the way that I remember this person was having trouble even staying in their residency program. The director was, you know, how can we go on like this if you're going to be, you know, coming in to draw blood and you're wearing a mask? And so you do see it play out probably differently in different professions. Some professions might be more likely to create problems where you have, for example, exposure to blood, people who might be doing construction work where there's exposure to asbestos, things like that, where it could create a problem. I would imagine some people with OCD would deliberately stay away from those kinds of professions, but
so it has to almost always interfere with some, it has to interfere, it has to be
yes.
intrusive enough to cause a problem.
Exactly.
Either for the person or for their family.
Yes, yes. So, right. So it's got to get in the way. And one of the things that often is overlooked is the way that OCD does impact the family. It's kind of like mm-hmm. that extra family member that nobody wants to have around, or a third wheel in a relationship. We've done some research in our clinic looking at couples treatment for, you know, couples that where one partner has OCD. And we involve the person without OCD because that person often feels like they're between a rock and a hard place. They want to try to explain to the person, no, you didn't hit a body. That's a speed bump. Why do you keep going back to check? That doesn't make any sense. But that just leads to arguments. And the person with OCD doesn't seem to really understand that. They're still going back to check. And on the other hand, the person without OCD sometimes feels like it's just, I might as well just give in and help the person with their rituals, because if I don't, they're going to get really anxious. They're going to cause an argument. It's going to be ugliness. So you see these family members, they have a difficult time.
And I would think, what about trauma? Does that play a role?
There is some research that OCD is more prevalent among folks who have gone through a traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I would think the intrusive thoughts or the anxiety prevents people from seeking help.
Very much. Yeah. So often, and you know, it's also the case with post-traumatic stress disorder. After a traumatic event, the person has more anxiety. They have more intrusive thoughts. And sometimes people don't want to explain that to their, you know, clinicians. We see that a lot with also with new parents who have had a baby and they're thinking, you know, unwanted. Of course, they're not going to really hurt their baby, but they have thoughts. What if I did something terrible to the baby? What if I put them in the microwave or threw them out the window? Parents sometimes think like that, even when they love their babies, but they're afraid to say anything because they're afraid that they're going to get locked up if they bring that up, even to a doctor. Lots of doctors don't understand what's going on and might think that they have, let's say, something like postpartum psychosis, mm-hmm. where you are at risk for hurting your baby, but that's extremely rare.
I'm thinking back to, you know, my mother, and when she was alive and I hadn't seen her for a long time, and she came back, and I had not ever been aware that she had developed some OCD. And one of them was just difficulty, but, you know, wanting to clean one's nose with a tissue. And the issue that I faced, in addition to a family member, was, you know, well, had this been there before? Had I missed it? Had certain things happened? And then what to do about it? And being the good doctor, I went and read everything I could. And what I found was OCD is pretty difficult.
Tell
us, why is it difficult? Because it's not just the same as, let's say, depression, which is could be really difficult too. How do you begin to think about it?
Yeah, well, so we think about it in terms of the vicious cycle that I mentioned earlier. People with OCD end up doing things that seem like they're going to make them feel better, make them safer, but they end up just becoming more and more of the problem. Again, think of someone who touches a doorknob and is afraid that they are you know, going to get sick from germs. And so they go and they wash their hands. Seems like a smart strategy to do because then you're not going to get sick. The problem is the person then, I guess, never has a chance to learn that doorknobs are actually quite safe. You're very unlikely to get sick. But if you're always washing your hands after you touch a doorknob, you never have a chance to find that out. And over time, the fear of germs is going to snowball. First, it's doorknobs, then it's railings, and then it's shaking hands with other people and things like that. And so you have to convince people with OCD to give up these kinds of safety strategies, these compulsive rituals, in order for them to learn that their thoughts are senseless and the situations they're afraid of are not really dangerous.
But you can't apply the Bob Newhart approach is just get over it.
It would be nice.
You can't just tell people that, right?
No, we don't do that.
What are the strategies you use?
The best form of treatment for OCD is a cognitive behavioral approach, cognitive behavior therapy, specifically called exposure and response prevention. And exposure means purposely get into it and face your fears, lean into your fears. So touch the doorknob, touch the railing, shake hands with other people, think about, let yourself worry about germs, but don't go wash your hands. Go about your day, do this over and over and over again and find out that nothing terrible happens, that you're less likely to get sick than you thought. And when we do this exposure and response prevention over the course of weeks, maybe even months, people learn that they don't have to be so afraid and that they don't need to rely on their rituals, their compulsive rituals, to manage their anxiety. It can be a very effective treatment. As you could imagine, though, the trick is helping people to kind of want to do it because it's a demanding treatment.
So what would be the first step to getting help, and what's the outlook for these patients?
So not every therapist, not every mental health clinician knows how to do good exposure therapy. That's an important thing. You got to find the right person. And what I would recommend, there are three organizations that people can look up online. One is the International OCD Foundation. They have a website, iocdf.org. And they also have a find a therapist link that you can find people in your area that know what they're doing. Another is the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies, ABCT.org. And the other is the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, ADAA. And so the first step is to find someone who has experience with OCD. Ask them questions before you go in and see them. Make sure they're trained in cognitive behavior therapy for OCD. So that's really, that's the first step. And you asked me something else.
About the outlook.
Yeah. Most people, if they get good cognitive behavior therapy and they do it, they're going to see some improvement. We know that about 60 to 70% of people have about a 60 to 70% reduction in symptoms. So it's actually, the outlook is quite optimistic. Again, it's a challenging therapy. You have to find the right therapist, and then you have to be willing to get in there and face your fears to learn that you don't have to be so afraid.
So if we think about the aging of the population and we see increasing rates of dementia, to do cognitive behavioral therapy, one has to be probably have some baseline levels of being able to cognate to be able to
yes.
understand impact and reaction. What do we do in those who maybe their mental health condition, whether it's dementia or otherwise, prevents them from doing CBT? Is there a magic pill?
It's a great question. And so folks are doing research on OCD in the elderly. There are medications that can be helpful for OCD. They don't. It's a little bit more hit or miss. So the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, things like Luvox and Zoloft and Anafrinil, so an older drug, these can be helpful for many cases. The research shows that the CBT is more effective. But again, if a person is unable to do cognitive behavior therapy, in many cases, they can get help with medications.
You know, as I think about maybe wrapping up here, I just want to, I know you edit a journal.
Yeah.
And I, having edited a journal in the past myself, I sometimes get really interesting things that come to me. Is there something that's come to you in the last number of years that you go, this was just an interesting piece of research?
Yeah, there's a group in Israel that's studying what's called relationship OCD, where people are afraid that maybe I'm not really in love with this person, or maybe I've picked the wrong person. And it's fascinating because, you know, you can't see love. Like, I'm married, I have the same last name as my wife, we share a bank account, we have a certificate that says we're married, but you can't see that. And so you have people with OCD who doubt, you know, am I really married? Am I really in love with this person? It's fascinating. These folks are doing some interesting research over there.
So are they obsessed with that idea?
They might be obsessed with it in a good way, though, in a good way.
And then they write articles.
Compulsively.
Well, we want to thank Dr. John Abramowitz being our guest today, talking about OCD, helping us understand and understand there is treatment for it. And that's the part that I want to take with me moving forward.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Well, thanks a lot, Adam and Jamila, for having me.
Well, we're going to take a short break. But then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Jamila and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. You can send your own comment or question to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura, what do you have?
The first question is, I've had migraines off and on for years that are certainly worse in the last few months since I've separated from my spouse. I really don't like taking medications that make me sleepy or drowsy. What would you recommend?
Well, first off, we're sorry to hear about the recent stress in your life. Everyone knows that stress makes migraines worse and can precipitate headaches. I'm sure some of what's happening is related to that stress.
And there are certainly medicines out there that can tackle both the stress that would get to probably the root cause of the increased frequency of your headaches. You know, maybe some of the anti-anxiety medications like the SSRIs that often help for the headaches and the stress.
Right. So if you're feeling depressed or anxious, it could certainly help that and some of that stress. Sometimes people that triptans, the migraine medicines that actually kind of reduce it, that are safe, that won't make you drowsy or sleepy. Though sometimes those medicines may be expensive or more so. I can understand patients not wanting to take some of the prescriptions, and we wouldn't necessarily recommend opiates.
Right.
We wouldn't really want to get you down that path. Some of the anti-nausea medicines could make you sleepy. Sometimes I just think a massage might go a long way, maybe cheaper in the long run, you know, so head and neck massage. Those shoulders can just pack a tremendous amount of tension, and that tension can press on those nerves in the back of the head.
You know, that's my answer right there. Now you're barking up the right tree.
Yeah, let's try something that doesn't have any side effects, right? Some gentle massage. I say gentle, though, because those neck and shoulder muscles be really tense and tight. And if you do it too hard, that actually can lead to headaches.
That's right.
Last thing, sometimes people take too many Advils, ibuprofens, acetaminophen, Tylenol. They take too much of those pain medications. And once you start taking those on a daily basis, they cause
rebound headaches.
Rebound headaches. And then you think, oh, I got to take that medicine again. And then the more you take the medicine, the more you get the headaches.
That's right.
And when the solution to that is
stop taking the Advil, the ibuprofen, and sometimes not injection of Phenergan or steroid might have to break the cycle for the rebound.
So talk with your doctor about it. Some really good thoughts. Laura, what's our very next house call?
Recently, I went to see my doctor and was having chest pain and a little shortness of breath. I didn't really think it was a heart problem because I'm young, healthy, and pretty physically active. However, my doctor did an ECG and told me I had pericarditis. That sounds incredibly serious. Should I be worried?
Well, I would have been. Walk in there going, you know, I got this little bit of this chest pain, a little shortness of breath, but I'm really feeling pretty good. I'm, you know, pretty physically active. I'm actually probably good looking, you know, And now you're telling me I got this pericarditis. What? Sounds kind of scary.
It does sound scary, but.
But.
A lot of times a pericarditis is caused by viruses that can cause inflammation in the heart sac.
Yeah, which sounds scary again. You know, we think about itises, so like tendonitis, this inflammation of the tendons, and pericarditis is inflammation of that sac. It's like the balloon. There's a small, thin balloon that surrounds the heart. We don't typically talk about it very much. You don't want that balloon to get real thick or inflamed. But pericarditis, it means that sac is a little bit inflamed. And you know what? When the heart's beating, that could be painful. It sounds really scary. Most times it's not. Probably the doctor would want to check some blood work. They may want to check some tests to see if there's anything else to be worried about. But a young, healthy person who's doing pretty good, they could probably take a little bit of medicine.
And it would be resolved.
Yeah. Sometimes they take a medicine called ibuprofen, which we talked about for the headaches. But for this case, for the pericarditis, you might have to take it for several weeks, or sometimes a medicine called colchicine. Sometimes you take both those medicines to really try to prevent it coming back. But you really do need to see someone who really knows that. They'll check a cardiogram on you, and they give you some real instructions. Like, you may not want to be exercising, running out and running on a bicycle right after you've been diagnosed.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you for that really good question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm 41, and I've been healthy all my life. Recently, I saw my doctor, and I had severely elevated blood pressures. My doctor also said this was because I was obese, but I know that my stress level is really high, like, say, 100 on a scale of 1 to 100. To what extent does the stress cause the high blood pressure versus the weight?
Yes and yes.
That is a great question.
How would you answer that, Jamil?
It both cause high blood pressure. Absolutely. Yep. It's well established that obesity increases our risk for lots of morbidity in this country. And stress puts a lot of strain or load on our bodies, specifically the brain, the heart. They take a pretty good hit, too.
Yeah, you know, when like people come in to see the doctor and they check their blood pressure and it's like 200 over 100 and they go, but it was normal 10 minutes ago. It's like, yeah, you come into the doctor, you get stressed. What's it like when your stress is 100 on that scale? That means you got stuff happening in your life that's not good right now. And we know that affects blood pressure. But on the other hand, it's not either or. Right? Because you might be easier to lose weight than to reduce the stress. It might be easier to reduce the stress than to lose weight. And if you do both of them together, you're probably going to get a pretty good decrease in your blood pressure.
And also looking at some of the lifestyle changes with diet and exercise that will help in both cases, the weight and your cardiovascular health.
Like physical activity.
Yes.
From your mouth to God's ears. Thank you so much for your house calls today. That'll conclude your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can send your own question or story to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our great guest co-host, Dr. Jamila Battle, and our guest today, Dr. John Abramowitz. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jamila Battle.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.